I have never seen this much interest, not just from the agencies in joining the process, but from the public at large.
Working to address homelessness in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 15th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Arctic drought and the carbon implications.
Fire is the most likely agent to be responsible for that in the, over the next few decades.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
A search is underway in Denali National Park for a missing small plane. Two Denali Park residents are known to be on board the blue and white Cessna 185. The aircraft's owner and pilot, Daniel McGregor, and independent wildlife scientist, Gordon Haber. National Park Service spokeswoman Chris Pfister says McGregor flew Haber out to observe wolves yesterday.
We know that they didn't return yesterday as planned when it got dark, and we are searching basically the entire north side of the park right now because we don't have an exact idea of where they might be.
Pfister says wolves generally roam the northern part of the park, and seven planes employed in the search are concentrating on that area.
Four from the Civil Air Patrol based out of Fairbanks that will be searching the north side of the park. We have our park plane out that is primarily going to be looking to track where the wolves are to see if there's a possibility we could locate the plane in that area. We have a plane from the Alaska Wildlife Troopers that will be checking all the known landing strips in the area, and also a C-130 will be flying high overhead to monitor for any ELT signals.
Pfister says the Park Service is using radio tracking to locate collared wolves that could narrow down the area where the plane could be. She says weather in the park Wednesday was generally clear, but that there were areas of low-level fog. Haber, a vocal advocate for protection of wolves, has logged thousands of hours in the air, observing the animals in Alaska over the last 40 years. This afternoon, representatives from more than 30 agencies, organizations, and government departments gathered at Anchorage City Hall for the initial meeting of the homeless team. They came at the request of Mayor Dan Sullivan, who from the start of his administration has made dealing with the city homeless chronic inebriate population a major goal of his administration. It's a long-standing, ever-worsening problem that's captured even more public attention and concern with the deaths of a dozen street and camp-dwelling people since May. One was a homicide. Police and autopsies indicate the others were fatalities to the lifestyle. The mayor told the group he hoped that through their combined efforts, they could achieve three major goals.
Really, in a compassionate mode, is reduce the deaths among that population, which we've seen over the last few months has been of crisis proportion. We want to reduce the violence to that population and amongst themselves. We've obviously had incidents of people attacking our homeless population, oftentimes the chronic public inebriate, who oftentimes doesn't have the defenses to take care of themselves. And we also want to protect neighborhoods and reduce the impact on property and neighborhoods that these individuals are causing because of their activities and their actions.
Mayor Sullivan also laid out a strategy he thought would guide the combined groups toward those goals. The first task entails a group self-appraisal.
We want them to identify all the current resources and efforts in the community spent on dealing with this population.
Once that's done, the Anchorage mayor wants to begin eliminating the homeless camps that exist throughout the city.
We want to determine if we can successfully intervene in the homeless camp scenario by closing down the camp while providing each of the people within that camp supportive services.
Sullivan says he wants the group to provide concrete data showing results toward benchmarks of progress. Another not insignificant goal is to use the collective expertise of the group to find grants and other funding. Meetings on Anchorage's homeless chronic inebriates are hardly new in the city, but today's gathering exhibited a quality that the director of Anchorage's Health and Human Services Department, Diane Engel, says fosters increased hope.
In my 5 years with municipal government, I have never seen this much interest, not just from the agencies in joining the process, but from the public at large. It's an incredible response to the mayor's initiative.
The standing room status at the meeting seemed to underscore Ingalls' observation, as well as showing Anchorage's determination to find a solution to a long-standing situation. The Alaska Public Offices Commission confirms an emailed press release saying that Governor Sean Parnell has filed for election to the state's highest office. The filing is not yet posted on APOC's website. A letter of intent on record with the commission allows a candidate to organize a campaign committee and to begin accepting contributions for the 2010 election cycle. It usually precedes filing with the Division of Elections to be put on the ballot. Parnell joins Valdez Representative John Harris and Valdez former Mayor Bill Walker in the race for the Republican nomination. In his announcement, the governor says he wants to make the economy the central part of his campaign, saying, quote, Alaska's resources need to be more fully explored and developed. Our young people need to be better prepared in school for jobs, and Alaskans need a steady hand on the state's finances so that our state lives within its means. Attempts to reach Parnell today have not been successful. Alaska Congressman Don Young spent more campaign money than he brought in during the last quarter. The 19-term Republican filed disclosure forms this week with the Federal Elections Commission. They show Young's campaign brought in about $87,000 in the past 3 months. It spent more than $93,000 and more than half of that on legal fees. Young's chief of staff, Pamela Day, says most of the legal bill money, $46,000, paid off old debt. Day says the campaign hired a Washington, D.C. law firm earlier this year to audit its books and look over paperwork to make sure they are in compliance. Young's campaign staff has changed in the last year.
We had gone through the campaign and done some house cleaning, housekeeping to make sure that everything over the last few years had been on the up and up. And at this point, everything looks good. And so we wanted to go ahead and make sure we paid off that those debts that we owed to the law firm that did the work for us.
The money went to the D.C. firm of Tobin, O'Connor, Ewing, and Richard. In the past 2 years, Young has also paid other legal bills from his campaign chests, totaling more than $1.2 million because of a federal investigation. He's also spent more than $73,000 from a separate legal expense fund set up last year. Young has not talked about the investigation, other than to say he's done nothing wrong. The congressman now has on hand $123,000 in campaign money. That's a far cry from the $1.5 million he had amassed during this point in the last election cycle. Pamela Day says Young was able to raise more money when he chaired the Natural Resources and Transportation Committees. Young was the top Republican on the House Natural Resources Committee until last December, when he stepped down from the leadership role. Fellow Republicans threatened to remove him because of the ongoing federal investigation. Candidates running for national office in 2010 have until midnight East Coast time to file their campaign's financial paperwork. As of this afternoon, Young was the only candidate to have filed. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Yukon First Nation educators call for a new style of education.
There's a lot of finger pointing going on. And there's recognition that things need to change, but it's very difficult for large systems to figure out how to do that.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfort. Details at condor.com. Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is November 2nd. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
A study that looks at the Arctic's role in absorbing carbon dioxide finds that the job of storing CO2 could be ending in coming decades, and the Arctic may become an emitter of carbon dioxide and methane. David McGuire is a USGS and University of Alaska Fairbanks scientist who reviewed past studies and compiled the latest findings. He says since the end of the last ice age, the Arctic has absorbed about 800 million metric tons of global carbon.
It's on the order of probably 10 to 15% of the current sink activities of the land and ocean combined.
Carbon is absorbed in permafrost and is locked there, as permafrost does not decompose its carbon like active soil does. But McGuire says as the Arctic warms, the way the area acts as a carbon sink may change. As shrubs and trees advance into tundra, those plants will absorb CO2 through photosynthesis. But he says these possible benefits of a warmer Arctic are small and a long way off. A more likely scenario is an increase in release of carbon from the Arctic because of drought and what he calls the browning of the boreal forests.
That drought is potentially causing the boreal forests to be to take up less carbon from the atmosphere due to the effects of drought on photosynthesis. And then the other issue is fire. The projections are, almost all the projections I know of, show increased fire activity. And fire, of course, is a very fast way of getting carbon off the land into the atmosphere.
McGuire says the oceans absorb CO2 through something called the solubility pump and the biological pump. He says the solubility pump will become less effective as ocean temperatures rise because CO2 is less dissolvable in warmer water. However, the biological pump may be more active as photosynthesis ramps up in ocean areas previously covered in ice.
I don't think we completely understand how the relative strength of those two pumps will change, but it's a sensitivity that we pointed out in the paper that needs to be looked at a little bit closer.
McGuire says defining what is meant by the Arctic was part of this study, vast oceans and land masses that are perennially frozen.
We ended up defining it as boreal North America, which is basically Canada and Alaska, boreal Asia, which is area of Russia to the east of the Urals, down to about 45 degrees north, and then we sort of had this area of boreal Europe that was basically Russia east of the Urals as well as the Scandinavian countries.
How dramatically and when the Arctic may reverse its course and go from climate protector by absorbing mass amounts of carbon dioxide to climate nemesis and belching more carbon and methane out than it takes in is difficult to pin down. But McGuire says the drying conditions in the Arctic are telling.
Fire is the most likely agent to be responsible for that in over the next few decades.
As permafrost melts, plant decomposition and erosion would add to the reversal of the Arctic's role in global climate change. A court challenge against the Murkowski administration's takeover of coastal zone management will go ahead. A judge has denied the state's motion to throw the case out. The suit was filed last May by 6 Bristol Bay Native tribal organizations against the State Department of Natural Resources' 2005 Bristol Bay Area Plan. Tuesday, Judge Fred Torisi made the decision to deny parts of the state of Alaska's motion to dismiss the case. The tribes believe the area management plan, which addresses about 12 million acres of land, was improperly altered in 2005 by changing many of its use classifications, covering most of the lands included in the plan. The 2005 Bristol Bay plan has classified some lands as available for mineral exploration, lands that had previously not specifically been classified that way. The proposed Pebble Mine, which is located on some of the reclassified lands, the DNR argued that the area plan was not a regulation, but strictly a planning tool that set the standards for future action. The suit was filed on behalf of the Non-Dalton Tribal Council, the Kaliganuk Village Council, the Nustuyahok Traditional Council, and Ekwa Council, and the Chugyung Tribal Council, and the Leevalak Village Council. A separate state motion for dismissal in another area still awaits the judge's decision. Senator Mark Begich railed on the Senate floor today about what he called a myth, that Democratic-led health care legislation will lead to rationing.
Opponents of health insurance reform have recently resurrected the word to suggest that Americans will get less care when reform legislation passes. Is there anything more cynical than that? Telling Americans that their health care will be rationed because of reform?
that they'll lose or get less care when Congress and the president finally take action? The defenders of the status quo ought to be embarrassed. They know the opposite is true.
Begich is part of a group of freshman Democrat senators who are speaking weekly on the health insurance legislation. He says, according to the Census Bureau, 10,000 Alaskans have lost health insurance this year. In an interview this afternoon, Begich said there are still things he wants to see added that were not included in the Democratic-led bill passed by the Senate Finance Committee this week. He wants the federal health program opened up to anyone who'd like to buy in, and he wants to be able to negotiate prescription drug costs. Begich says now that each of the bills are out of committee, all senators can participate in the debate and propose their own amendments, which he plans to do.
Kind of my view is a good starting point is actually bringing it now in this process that we're done with all the committees, because as a member, I've not participated in the committee structures. I'm not a member of one of those committees. But now the fact that everyone gets to engage now, I think is going to be good. It's going to be very robust discussion, and I'm looking forward to it.
Begich says no matter what, the final bill must be deficit neutral. He and a group of moderate Democrats have laid that down as a deal breaker. Republicans complained this week about a report by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office that shows the Finance Committee's bill won't raise the deficit. They say that's false, but Begich says that's just politics.
They will always have an excuse, and each day the excuse will change. But the same issue is there, and that is they don't want any reform. They want to keep it business as usual. And I can tell you in Alaska, when your premiums have doubled in the last 10 years, and they're potentially going to double again in the next seven, business as usual is unacceptable.
Begich disagrees with Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski that the Finance Committee bill will cost Americans more. Instead, Begich says costs will increase if action is not taken.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Let's Cite Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing. Teachers love Let's Cite Alaska. You can discover Let's Cite Alaska at LITSITE.org. Let's Cite Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
A First Nations Education Forum has heard if you want to change the education system, then you have to start from scratch. In fact, the executive director of Classroom Connections told delegates it's time to look at a new model other than the classroom. That's something some Yukon teachers are trying, the CBC's Leonard Linkletter reports.
Heather McTaggart says change starts at the community level.
You cannot fix education or improve education without addressing what's going on at home.
McTaggart says the current education system did well with kindergarten, but it goes downhill from there. She says kindergarten is the only place where students have the freedom to be creative and pursue things they are interested in. That's something Melanie Bennett is trying to change at Tikini Elementary School. That's where they've started a drum group and begin the day with O Canada in Southern Tishoni.
It takes the willingness of a person to want to go out and learn about it and bring it in and do the activities with the kids.
Bennett says it builds self-esteem in First Nation kids, which in turn helps their academics. McTaggart would like to see a shift away from the classroom and toward a new way of education based on interests. She says education officials are not sold.
So there's a lot of finger-pointing going on, and there's recognition that things need to change, but it's very difficult for large systems to figure out how to do that.
McTaggart says until there's a recognition that home, community, and schools must work together, there will be problems in education. Leonard Linklater, Whitehorse.
A new authority set up to deal with trash in Southeast Alaska will be forming a board of directors and adopting bylaws over the next year. Voters in Petersburg, Wrangell, Thorne Bay, and Craig last week approved the startup of a Southeast Alaska Regional Solid Waste Authority. Petersburg's Public Works Director, Carl Hagerman, is on the Solid Waste Subcommittee of the Regional Economic Development Organization Southeast Conference.
It's very gratifying to see that everybody seems to understand what the goal is and that the authority is a positive thing for the region. It's disappointing that not more communities chose to put it on the ballot this year. But I'm hopeful that with the overwhelming support that it received in the various elections that it was involved in, and hopefully some success in this first year, that other communities will get involved in the following years and will get a more representative voice and a more collaborative effort on solid waste issues in the region.
Hagerman says within the next 2 months, the four cities will appoint a representative for the authority's board of directors. The new board will meet to adopt bylaws covering how and when the group meets and how it will operate. Some goals of the new authority are to lower the cost of dealing with garbage and to create jobs if the towns decide to pursue a regional landfill. Hagerman says each participating community has to approve any solution for solid waste.
Whatever project the authority decides to proceed with, they have to fine-tune a development plan specifically for that project. That project could be in one community, it could be in all four, but every municipal entity that is involved with the authority must approve that development plan before the authority moves forward. So if it's a landfill in Wrangell, that's the answer. Petersburg has to approve that idea, that development plan, as well as Thorne Bay and Craig.
Other Southeast towns may still join the authority in future years. The Board of Directors will have to decide whether it wants to hire any staff, although the group does not yet have much money for operations. Hagerman says they're hoping to use about $25,000 given to the Southeast Conference by various Southeast communities for starting up the new entity. He says member communities won't necessarily be customers of the new organization, and future customers don't have to join.
Again, the authority is going to be run as a business, and it's going to seek customers. You don't necessarily have to be part of the authority or a member of the authority to be a customer of the authority. So there could be communities that are customers of the authority but aren't interested in really being involved at the board of director level. It really remains to be seen, as I said at the outset of the interview. It's really breaking new trail, you know, over the whole state on this issue. So it'll be very interesting to see how it all develops.
The state legislature passed a bill in 2006 allowing for the formation of regional solid waste authorities, and Southeast's group is the first to form in Alaska. The village of Pelican has received $100,000 in state disaster relief money to help rebuild a flume that collapsed in August. The collapse caused an immediate shortage of water and power to Pelican. A temporary solution is in place, but now officials are looking at another serious issue, the potential release of ammonia from the Pelican Seafoods plant. From Sitka, KCAW's Ed Ronco has this update.
The Pelican flume collapsed on August 20th, and since then, the town's utility has been running on diesel power. According to government documents, Cake Tribal Corporation, which runs the utility, can no longer afford to supply power to Pelican Seafoods. Mayor Patty Phillips.
Even though we are on 100% diesel, it's costing $17,000 a month to keep the freezers going at the plant.
Those freezers, three stories tall, use anhydrous ammonia, which boils at an extremely low temperature. If the freezers aren't running, the anhydrous ammonia inside them could expand and be released. And that's bad news for the more than 100 people who live in Pelican. So before those freezers go offline, Pelican has to get some of that ammonia out of there. A variety of solutions have been talked about, including a controlled release into the atmosphere. Phillips says that probably won't be what ends up happening.
The likeliest scenario, the way I understand it, is Cake Tribal Corporation has hired an ammonia specialist, and he's looking into the cost of purchasing tanks large enough to evacuate the ammonia into. Those have to be purchased and shipped from wherever they are purchased from and sent to Juneau, then to Pelican.
It's not known how long that could take. Pelican is getting $100,000 in disaster relief money from the state, and Phillips says her community is grateful for the assistance.
I'm just so thankful that, you know, Governor Parnell's administration has just stepped right in there and, you know, worked with the various state agencies to get resources to Pelican to help us identify what the problems and issues are and help us to find solutions to get them taken care of.
But State Senator Bert Stedman says the $100,000 is not enough money.
I think that $100,000 is a little light. I don't know what the final bill is going to be, but just looking at the work being done over there, it's going to be more than $100,000.
Stedman and other officials toured Pelican last week. He said they wanted to get out ahead of any new problems that might arise as a result of the flume collapse. and he said what he saw wasn't pretty.
Well, I think there should have been more maintenance money put into the flume. There's no doubt about that. The condition of it is it's in a sad state of affairs. So, you know, the community basically has to rebuild that or see that it gets rebuilt.
Mayor Phillips says it could be a while before things get back to normal. The flume's collapse has done no favors for the town's fishing industry. The ice machine is offline, which will affect the local fleet's winter king fishing. In the meantime, repairs continue on the flume, and improvements to the electric and water systems are expected to continue until next year. I'm Ed Ronco.
A federal agency says it will not list two populations of spotted seals off Alaska's coast as threatened or endangered. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced today it will, however, list a population of spotted seals that live off the coasts of Russia and China as threatened. The agency says the 200,000 spotted seals in and near Alaska are not in danger of extinction or likely to become endangered in the foreseeable future. The Center for Biological Diversity is seeking a listing for spotted seals and other northern seals because of losses in sea ice due to global warming. Spotted seals use the edge of sea ice far from predators to give birth and nurse pups. A fishing vessel caught fire and sank off Admiralty Island in southeast Alaska. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says the Alaskan Pride had about 400 gallons of diesel fuel and an unknown amount of lube and engine oil on it when a fire broke out Tuesday. Two crew members were unable to control the fire and sent a mayday at 10:40 p.m. They used a raft to abandon the boat. The crew members were picked up by a state ferry. The Coast Guard flew over the vessel Wednesday morning and reported that the 55-foot Alaskan Pride was still on fire. The vessel then sank in several hundred feet of water in Square Cove. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, the CBC's Leonard Linklater from Whitehorse, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Alaska Communication Systems, ACS, offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, you can fight the flu by regularly disinfecting hard surfaces, avoid touching your mouth, nose, and eyes, and wear a face mask if you are sick and in close contact with others. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
LitSite Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing. Teachers love LitSite Alaska. You can discover LitSite Alaska at LITSITE.org. LitSite Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.